One of the many things I love about this work is that it's so humanizing because we're looking at it from a meta perspective. And paradoxically, at the same time, we're feeling it together profoundly personally. It is so personal and brings this opportunity for so much compassion from me as a facilitator, but much more importantly, in the client for themselves, when they look at it and they go, oh my God, no wonder why I've been in so much pain. No wonder why I haven't been able to stay loyal. Hey, folks, welcome to the Brilliant Body Podcast, a forum to learn about and liberate the brilliance of your body and ultimately to expand the meaning and experience of intelligence. Join me, Ali Mazay, and other body masters to explore pioneering and varied perspectives on what it means and feels like to be embodied. So many people feel disconnected from their bodies due to emotional or physical pain or even conditioning and lack of education. Others feel quite at home in their bodies yet want to learn to have more pleasure, awareness, and access to the body's guidance. This podcast is for everybody. Each one of my trailblazing guests has studied their own bodies and others' bodies for decades and will share their expertise and unique mission, how to thrive as a body. So join us and reclaim your body's brilliance. All righty. Are you there?
Let's do it.
All right. I'm excited. So it's so good to be with you, Lauren, as it always is in whatever context we're sharing. And I'm so excited to share a conversation with our audience about what the hell I do for most of my time, namely personal geometry, the method that I've been developing for many years now to apply therapeutically in the realm of predominantly body and sexual issues and healing, and also sobriety support and insight as to how addictions are functioning, which can be absolutely transformational very quickly, and any problem or issue that people have. And you and I have known each other for many years now. We met in a Walking in Your Shoes training oh so many years ago. And also you recently, this past year, became my student, my star student, dare I say protege in personal geometry, to add to all your other great skills and talents and capacities, including being a TV producer. So I thought, who better to have this conversation about the work that I do and how I utilize and apply and benefit from the brilliance of not just my body, but every client's body, in order to really access the deepest truth for the deepest healing that a client is seeking. So here we go with the conversation about that and anything else that may arise as we talk about body intelligence in the realm of therapeutic healing and specifically personal geometry and any other work that I'm doing and you are also doing. So there we have it.
Well, welcome to the hot seat. I know that you're not usually in this role, so I'm just really grateful, you know, not only to be your student, to be sharing this work and to be learning from you, but also to be a part of this incredible podcast and to be just in a position to apply my inquisitive mind to you and hear all of your insights. So one of the things I love as a storyteller about personal geometry is that, to me, it is the human story in motion. And so with that in mind, I wanted to start our conversation by asking you how your brilliant body discovered personal geometry.
There's so many answers that spring to mind almost simultaneously. I was in a class with my family constellation mentor, Jane Peterson, who was talking about bodies in space, is what she calls this capacity that we have as humans and animals. I believe any living being has, because in order to survive on planet Earth, we have to know where our bodies are, as she puts it, in space. in relationship to anyone and anything. And being in her class probably 10 years ago, it was one of those experiences where suddenly I recognized something that I had actually understood my whole life and been living by, utilizing, benefiting from, and surviving with, which was, how do I experience sensationally as a body my relationship to anyone who's actually in my physical presence, but also with whom I'm related internally in my thoughts, in my emotions, in my spiritual experience, and my sexual experience, in my imaginary experience, in my fears, in my emotions, in my aspirations. So I think this was particularly vivid for me, this understanding, because I grew up as a dancer, which was all about where you are in space, where your joints are in relationship to each other in order to make any particular gesture or athletic expertise. You have to really know and master where your joints are in relationship to each other. Our joints are full of intelligence, proprioceptors specifically, which is why I ended up developing for over 40 years my form of body work, which that's another topic, but it's all based on our joints' understanding of where we are in relationship to each other, our other aspects of our bodies and other bodies. And then I've found different mentors in body arts along the way, including, as I said, Jane Peterson. We did an episode with her many moons ago, and we get more into that as well. And then there's constellation work, which actually underutilizes this capacity and nonetheless taught me greatly about a method that is now quite popular all over the world and gaining ground every day, to be able to really externalize and experience and co-experience anyone's family system and trauma system, basically, to be able to see where the love isn't flowing and again, externalize it in a way that makes it so visual and visceral and sensational that we can actually see, make conscious, and make changes to our experience of our family systems and our relationship to anyone or anything. I just came along, and because I was invited to work at the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles and was there for 5 years and had so many constraints working with people who were often in active detox. They were often dissociated and very stressed, away from their families as they were going through their rehab intensives. Sometimes they only had a half an hour to have a deep impact on their healing process and bring them a lot of insight, as well as to be able to communicate that to the therapeutic team. So I had to get much more efficient in a way that most family constellation work is not. It's also can seem very abstract and even woo to a lot of people, because there's a lot of focus on ancestors and transgenerational trauma. There's a lot of emphasis on representing people who might be dead or people we've never met, or bringing in strangers in the group to represent people that they've never met. And basically, we don't like to use this word, but channel in information through our felt sense and our somatic intelligence, information and experience, and even metabolize the trauma or the blockages that might be showing up for the client. And personal geometry skips a lot of that and goes right to, how does the body map a particular issue? How do we externalize that, either with colored mats, with post-its, with salt shakers, with rocks or objects or anything that can physically represent those maps, so that we can really feel them and decide if we want to keep them that way or discover ways to change those external maps and thereby rewire our internal maps. It's quite a sensational experience that sometimes language inadequately describes, or I inadequately describe, but it's very impressive when it's happening, because our bodies recognize the truth of it, and our bodies are so much more honest than our psyches tend to be, that in a therapeutic realm can often just blab on about what we think is the problem, or what we think the content is, or the issue is, or even the solution is. But when you ask the body to explain it and express what it knows about whatever the issue is, it just goes right to it and makes it all the more palpable and conscious and available to change. So that was a long answer to a short
question. I love it. And I think a really great segue into my second question, because I do think part of the challenge of this work, you know, you and I understand, and many people in the therapeutic world will understand words such as externalize and resistance and system and somatic. But for, let's say, someone who is a total layman, who has no sense of any of these things, no context, how would you describe how this modality works, how a session would work, and how you like to work as a facilitator?
Yeah. So if somebody comes in and says, I'm really struggling in my marriage, let's do a common one. I'm struggling in my marriage. I have much more libido than my partner does, or I have much less than my partner does. I've had my hormones checked. I love this person. My hormones are fine. Yeah, I can feel resentful in the relationship sometimes, but I just don't know what the problem is. You know, we've been to couples therapy. It's still not working. We're missing more intimacy. I mean, this is a very general but common occurrence and experience. So, of course, I can ask them about their background, how they met, what their dynamic is, you know, whether there's ever been affairs, what someone's experience of their own personal sexuality is, for example. But if somebody, particularly self-aware or not, if we go right to, after we determine what it exactly it is they want to change in their life and what is bothering them, which is part of the art of it, is really clarifying, why are you here, and what in a perfect world are you wanting to change today if you could change anything? What is that contract? What is that mandate for the session, you could say, which focuses my guidance on where to take them? Where do we even begin with what the issues are? What are the components of the inquiry or of the dynamic of that relationship? I work with foam mats usually if it's an in-person session, because they're big, they're colored, they're very easy to stand on. I got mine at Michael's. I don't know where you got yours, in Los Angeles. And we give these triangle cutouts to them because that represents the gaze. And it is so important to know the directionality of where somebody places, for example, a mat for themselves facing forward. And then if you ask them to place a mat for their spouse, for example, they might place that mat 5 feet away, off to an angle on the left, and the triangle is facing the corner of a room. In other words, shows that that client doesn't feel their spouse can see them. And all they see in the stance that they placed their mat is the backside of their spouse, who's 5 feet away and has their back to them and is angled off looking at something else other than them. And hopefully, just by describing that configuration, when you're listening to this, you have a sense of, oh, I know what that feels like as a body to be standing there in relation to somebody who's 5 feet away from me at an angle to my left, say a 45 degree angle, and their back is to me. If that's your spouse or any number of other people in your life, that's probably not going to feel great. That's certainly not conducive to having, you know, hot, heavy sex or slow, loving, intimate sex, or hopefully a combination of the two. It's not conducive to that. So by just asking somebody to place those two things, they've immediately diagrammed not just how they're experiencing the relationship physically and emotionally, but there's an immediate felt sense. Most people who look at that, there's a universal sense of, I know how that feels, and most people aren't going to feel great about it. So we begin a session. That's in the first 30 seconds you can do that with somebody. They can acknowledge it. And what happens is, as soon as in constellation work, we call seeing what is, or feeling what is, or accepting what is, there is a big relief in the nervous system, in the psyche, even if it's painful, to be able to recognize what we've been carrying around and be able to see and feel and share with somebody else, yes, that's what it's like. That's what it's been like. That in itself is deeply healing and doesn't take weeks and weeks and weeks of therapy to talk about it and describe something that doesn't really hit the sweet spot or the pain spot of what that dynamic is. So from there, you start following the breadcrumbs. When the client then says, yeah, that's what it's like, they're always working. And then you ask them to place their experience of their spouse's work and where does that mat go? Or they might say, yeah, their parent is dying and they're always focused on that. Or it might turn out that actually they're focused on some other person that the client is concerned or knows that their spouse is sexually or emotionally distracted by or even involved with. So we start to just build and unfold whatever the relevant body maps are that evoke the emotion and the hidden meanings and opportunities for revelation and liberation that can come from this whole process. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and I love what you're driving at in this example, which is the potential that we all have for, and I'm going to use a framework that's going to challenge you, which is bypass that happens when we are in our heads. We're not in the body. And I want to throw that out there to kind of prod you. So please.
Yeah, react. You know my bugaboo. Yes,
I know.
Struggle with the language. I'm in my body. I'm connected to my body. I'm disconnected from my body, because I'm like, well, then you'd be dead. There is no such thing. And then if someone says, well, but my mind is disconnected from my body. So what does that mean? Let's just see what do people mean when they say that? They basically mean, I believe, that they're not feeling their body. They're not attending to it. They're not noticing it. They're not experiencing themselves as a body. But what bothers me about it, and this has been going on since I was a kid, younger than my college days, but I don't know, it must be a past life issue, but I have a real vendetta almost against Descartes. And I wrote a very, very long paper about it in college, about the Cartesian divide and how supposedly we are not our bodies. And this split has just haunted most industrialized societies for hundreds of years and had massive consequences in unlimited ways. But what bothers me about, I'm not in my body, begs the question, then who is I? I am not in my body. That means I is actually my mind, my psyche, the conscious cognitive mind is the I, not the rest of what's going on as not just a flesh being in a physiological way, but all the instinct and intuition and emotionality and magic And genius of the body is also I. The sexuality of the body is also I. So even speaking this way, I'm in my body or I'm out of my body, is erroneous. It's just, it sets us up for this embedded misunderstanding that I feel has dire consequences in most of our lives. And I realize there's all kinds of masterful, brilliant people in the embodiment world who use those prepositions all the time. But I cringe. I have to say, I cringe whenever I hear it. And I use that too, because it's so common. You know, we've all been around those phrases, but I try to watch that in myself as much as possible and try to speak the unification of myself by the choice of words that I use, knowing full well that I could always be more consciously, cognitively aware of my body experience and my experience as a body. And that's a lifelong challenge and aspiration of mine, something I really value, thus the Brilliant Body Podcast. And yet, you know, it's such a complex question. I mean, philosophers have been asking what is consciousness for thousands of years, you know, and humans are asking what that is. Perhaps animals do too. I don't know. They seem to understand it far better than we do, because they just are what they are, and they seem to live life, you know, live living. But it's an ongoing question that I believe this podcast is doing a good job at exploring, if not answering. So thanks for asking me that. I think it's a wonderful question, and I hope that was a wonderful answer.
I can't help myself. I just, I love to antagonize you when it comes to that. But as also someone who comes from that framework, and especially if you have body challenges, it's such an alluring premise to be invited into a dichotomy that I'm over here and my body's over here. And occasionally we can reflect each other, but we're not one and the same.
Sure, because bodies die. I mean, that's really upsetting. Of course, we don't want to think this is what we are, because they die. And then we're challenged with what happens to quote unquote me when I die. Now, here's the irony or the paradox of it. I have seen people die, and I know for sure that once death happens, the body is no longer the me that was there. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I personally don't believe or experience that people's I or me dies with the flesh that dies. That's the miracle of incarnation, is that when we are merged in life, we are merged. That's why and how we're alive. And when death happens, something does separate, whether that's, what is that, 7 ounces or whatever it is, the soul goes on and experiences another incarnation or plane or dimension or whatever it is. But what I do know for sure, and this is what my beloved Victory Body Project is about, which I hope to continue someday, is that our lives form our bodies, and our bodies form our lives and how we live our lives. If we are white, depending on our gender, depending on our shape, our height, what the body goes through. Are you injured young? Are you molested young? Are you considered beautiful? Are you considered ugly? What's your weight like? Do you have food to eat? You know, all these things that affect our bodies then dictate and orchestrate the lives that we end up leading. I've had so many forks in the road in my life because of things that happened to my body, and that changed my life, and how my life went then also changed my body. So I don't think it's possible to be a body and not be reflective of the life that it has led and will lead, even when that's in a constant state of organic transformation. That's my belief and my experience.
So to me, the call and response then with this work that you're doing is very much then expanding this discussion of consciousness as it pertains to the realm of therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. And there is a, for me at least, a time and place for therapy. I've gone through therapy myself. It's
you
a life
love therapy.
Group. There's so many beautiful therapists out there. There's so many incredible modalities. And yet I also know, as you do, that we can sit and also be in bypass around issues. And there's something stunning about saying one thing and then being asked to diagram it and going, oh, there it is out on the floor. I can't believe it. Totally
Yeah.
different than what I've been saying for perhaps months, if not years.
Yes, I love that. I did a presentation yesterday and this particular example came up. Sometimes we'll say, clients will say, oh, we were so close. Like, oh, my mother was my best friend. And then you ask them to map it and they place their mat down and then they'll place their parent's mat, in this case, a mother's mat, half covering their mat, their own mat. Now, that's close. But is it healthy? Does it actually feel good to you? Is that intimate in a way that is life enhancing, or is it hindering in some way? And now if you ask them that verbally, that question, even though they've just seen what they've placed and they're feeling it, and if they're still in, yeah, but we were so close, because it's so much easier to believe it's closeness and intimacy than oppression in some way, or even subjugation or imposition of some kind. But if you then ask them, oh, why don't you stand on your mat? Almost every time a body will hesitate, almost like you all of a sudden jammed on the brakes in it. It's like the body will recognize in a split second that they cannot stand on in their own place without also standing on their mother, in this example, or having to stand on only half of who they are. That can take 30 seconds or a minute for somebody to get, as a body, the impact of, oh, wait a minute, that's not the kind of closeness that I want to model my relationships on. That's not the version of closeness that actually feels good to me at all. In fact, I need to find a way, and that's my job to help them do that in this case, to have the right to their whole space, their whole place and right to existence. So what does that entail? What do they have to give up? What might they have to express? What might they have to feel just to have their mother's mat? I shouldn't say just to have passively, to move their mother's mat off of their own, which is a huge part of this process too, is once you place and then see and feel what you're diagramming, then what do you want to do about it? Do you want it to stay that way? And I can't tell you how many times people will say, well, can I move it? Can I move my own mat? As if it has to stay that way, as if it has to be that way. And what's weird is that they totally buy into this piece of colored thing on the floor as if it's actually the person, which is a beautiful thing, because clearly the body has invested in the experience enough to recognize that it has power, it has meaning, and that therefore it has efficacy in changing one's perspective, if not one's actual neurology or physiology. So this bypass thing, I love that you say that, and certainly many before me and concurrently are talking about that the body doesn't lie, that it's so honest that it will place things that our psyches can be avoiding. And it's such a beautiful opportunity to go smack to the truth so that we can actually see it, feel it, and move on, make a different truth, you know?
Brings up an interesting, another segue. which is to ask you to expand on roles. Because we talk about roles, and I think that this unfolds conversations. You mentioned your background at Center for Healthy Sex, working specifically with addiction. I know that you've worked at other addiction clinics, and you're currently working on a book also about the functions of addiction. So I want to hear a little bit about how you're reading roles in personal geometry work and what they have to tell you about different dysfunctions, addictions, and the types of relationships that keep us pinned back.
Okay, this is a huge question and a huge answer. Let me see what I can do with this. So, what I discovered working in the addiction field is that, again, within seconds or minutes, if I ask someone to place one for them and one for whatever substance or behavior they're considered addicted to, even with just two mats, you can see how that addiction is functioning. Is it covering them? Is it hiding them? Is it buffering them between them and somebody or something else that's troubling them or paining them in their lives? Is it trying to support them from behind, which I see probably the most frequently, is that addictions are actually trying to support somebody who's not getting that support otherwise, because addictions are reliable in ways that a lot of people did not experience their parents as being, or their spouse as being, their friends as being, or God or life as being. So that so much gets shown and experienced and becomes available for us to work with. Oh, so if that addiction is there trying to support you, what else could support you that actually is in a much more healthy relationship and isn't a destructive behavior or substance? So that's one thing in terms of being able to see a function. What I see over and over again, there's probably, what, 8 or 10 of them. You've been helping me with that data. And then in terms of roles, what you can also see, first of all, my particular view is that addicts tend to be viewed as the fuck-ups in the family. So a lot of the attention will go to the addict as being the one who's causing the problems and creating the embarrassment and the money drain and the attention suck and all the things. And yet when you really start to map further into the family system, what comes out is that it's helping the family avoid traumas that have occurred in the family, in previous generations in the family. It's helping the family avoid a marriage that isn't working in the parents, for example, or infidelity. It's helping the family not have to deal with, you know, a early death of a child or something that was just too painful. And what I find is that the addicts often tend to be the most sensitive person in the family. They're the ones carrying the shadow of the family. And so that is a very common role, is they're the fuck up of the family. Or you can get the opposite, where they're supposed to be the golden child of the family. That's also really common. And they only get off the hook when they're doing their addictive thing. Then they can get messy. They can stop being responsible. They can basically also express a fuck you to the family. Do you still love me even when I'm not the good one, even when I'm not succeeding and making the money and all pretty and handsome and successful? So that's another really common one. Emotional incest, which is
I was going to talk about emotional incest.
There we go. Okay. So this is so common. I won't just say just an addiction, though it can be so difficult to navigate that people can turn towards all kinds of destructive behaviors and to help them regulate or try to regulate and feel better, or self-medicate, as people say, which is that when there's not a happy marriage between two people, they have their children, and they're not getting their needs met by their spouse.
Whether that's emotional or sexual.
Yeah, whether emotionally or sexually. So we're going to put aside that we're not talking about sexual incest here. That's a whole other bag of beans there. Emotional incest, this is very common. It goes in both directions, and it can go same sex direction as well. But in this case, we're going to classic thing. The mother isn't getting her needs met by her husband, who's always working or is emotionally unavailable. She has this beautiful boy who's there, who adores her, who's focused on her, who needs her, who wants to spend time with her. And suddenly, or over a long period of time, the son is basically being enrolled in a spousal capacity that obviously is inappropriate for a child, for one thing, and also as a non-sexual, or what hopefully is a non-sexual relationship. So it becomes very difficult for that son to then liberate from and differentiate from the mother, let alone take on his own relationships, sexual and emotional relationship, because then the mother will feel abandoned and she'll have to deal with all the dissatisfaction and lack that she's been experiencing in her own marriage. And this can happen in subtle ways and very extreme ways. Mothers just disapproving of every partner that comes through the door with their son. That's, you know, really lots of movies and lots of books have been written about that, and people know that one. Or, you know, it can be very subtle where there's a sense of, oh my God, my mother won't be okay if I'm not there and I don't stay loyal to her and keep her the most important woman in my life. I personally believe this is a key reason why a lot of people don't stay loyal to their spouses. I saw this over and over again in the clinic, that one of the reasons why a spouse will cheat on their spouse is because there is this unconscious loyalty to the mother or to the father. And so they can't be loyal to their spouse, because then it would betray this emotional loyalty they have to their parent. So that can be a reason. It can seem counterintuitive, but it actually is pretty logical that, okay, if I stay loyal and monogamous and in love with my own spouse, that threatens my mother. But if I'm this carousing person who creates distance and even conflict with my spouse, they're not the threat that they would be if they were truly unified as a couple. They're not a threat to the parent who has needed them to be a stand-in spouse, a surrogate spouse, at least emotionally. And of course, this also happens sexually and physically too, where parents transgress those boundaries either implicitly or explicitly.
And so how would you, in the context of a body map, see this manifest? Like, you as a facilitator, how would you go, oh, I know what's going on?
Yeah, it's quite obvious. So if I ask somebody, for example, to place a mat for themselves, one for their mother and one for their father, which is often a really great place to begin, just for me and for them to get a sense of, okay, what is their initial template, their relational template they came with, or that is still deeply imprinted in their sense of relationship. And if somebody places a parent right next to them, so if we're talking about, again, a heterosexual male in this case, traditionally, and this gets into this whole thing about right and left, and is the right the masculine and the left the feminine, and we could have a whole conversation about that. Let's say in a heterosexual relationship where the male person is wanting to be in a more assertive role, let's say, more relational to the world. Most of us are right dominant. We reach out with our right hand. So that's partially why the right is considered to be a more assertive, dominant, therefore a masculine thing. Yes, these are stereotypes, et cetera, but there's something to it. However, I always have people feel, what is it for them? What feels more comfortable or not comfortable, whether they're on the right or the left of a partner or potential partner. That's another conversation. However, if a masculine man who's wanting a woman, a female being in a heterosexual relationship as a partner to be on their left, but they place their mother's mat in that position, it is a visual representation that that place is taken. A woman might be able to be on their right, which can often happen, which is super interesting. I've seen that countless times where a heterosexual man can place himself in between his mother on the left, his wife on the right. He's sandwiched between these two women and he feels dominated by his wife. And let's say that's the reason I have to go off and find some woman who's not bossing me and dominating me and telling me what to do. Well, when you point out that as long as his mother is in the position he says he wants his wife to hold, he wants to be with a nurturing woman who's more perhaps receptive or more traditionally feminine or just feels better to him on his left, then there has to be this whole negotiation of, okay, so what are you going to do about your mom holding that place? Are you going to move to your wife's right side? That's one possibility. In which case he's got to leave his mother. He's got to literally go, oh, I don't want to keep standing in for her husband, my father. I'm going to up and leave and move to a position that's better for my wife. Or he's got to do some work psychologically, emotionally, physiologically to bump his mother to a different position and accept and state and claim that he is not her husband. And he doesn't want to be. It's not his responsibility. It's not his duty. It's not his obligation. And it's no longer his loyalty. That's big work. And really helpful to be able to physicalize something that, again, somebody could have been talking about in therapy or complaining about, but not been able to really grasp in such a sensorial kind of way.
Well, in that particular example, let's say, if that's a client coming to you because he has a sex addiction and he's kind of, you know, getting his jollies with, let's say, a prostitute, or he's habitually chronically cheating on his wife, that addiction that in a therapeutic context or just from an outside perspective, we may be looking at with a lot of judgment and a lot of shame, is all of a sudden thrown into this totally different point of view, because actually that addiction is not only A, trying to fill this desperate need that he's really trying to heal himself, it's also pointing to where the dysfunction is happening, where the breakdown is physically materializing in him.
Love it. Couldn't have said it better. I absolutely love that. Absolutely. And that's one of the many things I love about this work is it's so humanizing because we're looking at it from a sort of meta perspective. And paradoxically, at the same time, we're feeling it together profoundly personally. It is so personal and brings this opportunity for so much compassion from me as a facilitator, but much more importantly, in the client for themselves, when they look at it and they go, oh my God, no wonder why I've been in so much pain. No wonder why I haven't been able to stay loyal. I personally don't see addiction as a disease in most cases or in many cases, and I don't want to quantify it. I think, okay, maybe it's an addiction, maybe it's not. In this case, physiologically, of course, we get, you know, hooked physiologically on all kinds of things. I'm not denying that. But the fact that it's this inescapable disease that we were born with and that we're going to die with, I do not see it that way. I just don't see how that's helpful other than to, what's the purpose of that? To help people not feel ashamed of something. Well, I'd rather help people not feel ashamed by being able to see how the whole system has been working so that they can grieve the pain they've been experiencing and trying to find a solution for, albeit in a misguided way or with limited creativity or resources. But as you say, it's such a great way to help somebody remember that they aren't just doing this thing, that's all they are, is their bad behavior. We're looking at it from this much more expanded perspective. I like to think about it as, I mean, this is how I see life anyway, that we are sort of the writers of our own script, and we're these souls who may or may not, quote unquote, choose our life story that is mutable as we live it. But that I'm always curious, particularly with something like addiction that has so much stigma and so much shame around it, to look at, okay, if you're looking in at this plot, what is this character, i.e. you, doing in this situation? What are you trying to accomplish or survive? What is the opportunity here to find this new path from this, again, expanded perspective? And how can we love this character in these difficult stories that so many of us live, to find a way that just feels much better to us and that doesn't need the kind of destructiveness that we can get into?
To open up the opportunity for us to realize agency.
Yeah.
Talk about that all the time. To me, I'm thinking about an addiction case that I think you and I discussed a couple months ago, but it was watching really almost, if you can imagine, a time lapse of this person building this map, and they had an addiction. I wanted to say it was a pretty heavy drinking problem. And they started building all of these things, and you just kind of saw these rings closing in on them. And again, these are bodies. And so physically, you're picturing how claustrophobic this experience is, of all of these pieces kind of closing in around this person. And then finally, he places alcoholism, and it's the only thing that's standing outside of the circle. And all of a sudden, that picture becomes clear that, wow, as long as he's standing on alcoholism, he's free.
Yes.
That is the only thing that's giving him agency in this pattern right now. And now we can begin to work understanding that that's the choice, that there is also another opportunity here.
Absolutely.
How can we give you something else to stand on?
Absolutely. And when we're looking at the geometry, in this case, you're describing kind of circles around him, it can show us, who can we move? Who can you move? Who needs to move so that you can get out of this? Or what do you need to say or see or feel or do in order to either pick up your mat that's has all this pressure surrounding and crushing in on you? Can you just pick it up and move it? What loyalties do you have to break, or belonging do you have to risk, in order to make those moves, in order to recognize that you have the agency, for one thing? Here's another role that people can play. Oh, I've got to be the healer in the family. I have to be the good one who makes everybody else feel good. So I'm going to let people focus on me, and I'll be the sunshine in the family. That's a role that I've seen a lot too. And it's too much pressure. So what does somebody have to recognize? And a lot of rage can come up. Sometimes that's the greatest resource to help people access that taboo thing. Well, I'm the sunshine in the family. I'm not supposed to be angry. I'm not supposed to be messy. I'm not supposed to upset people. So how can I, as a facilitator, help support them to liberate whatever energy that is, that can be expressed, again, through anger or through sadness or through some kind of assertiveness that is like, I am not just the sunshine. I'm also the rain and the thunder and the clear sky and the wind. I'm all these things, and I'm claiming them back. I'm blowing you all out. Like, I'm a volcano. I'm some kind of force that has the right to my space, God damn it, you know, which again, by doing this physically, and burning that into one's experience and translating it into the visual magic that we as seeing beings can do. We see something new, it repatterns us. And that's what we get to do. It's a great example of how can we get free of this cage without having to resort to the destructiveness of alcoholism.
I love the reclamation of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not all just trying to guide people into the positive, the happy. It's the balanced human experience, because we do need rage sometimes to survive.
Absolutely. There's so many emotions that we, at least a lot of us in a lot of industrialized cultures anyway, suppress. You know, it's the classic thing of most female-bodied people feel they're not supposed to ever be angry, and a lot of male-bodied people feel like they're not supposed to be sad or vulnerable. So there's all kinds of reclamation that needs to happen, particularly when there's been transgression and abuse. So that's a whole other opportunity.
I wanted to take this opportunity to actually talk about that and working with transgressors. And obviously this work does lend itself to working with people who have survived complex trauma, but how do you work with someone who has been the cause of complex trauma?
It's a really interesting question. It is not for everyone. I'll say that right there. I personally feel some degree of, you could even say, a calling to work with perpetrators in order to hopefully help them not be perpetrators and cause more damage and more pain and destruction than they already have or are worried or capable of perpetrating. So it's really something near and dear to my heart to work with anybody who is sincerely wanting to heal. That's a big condition right there. If somebody is either sociopathic or is already so damaged, the psyche as a being, because they underwent so much trauma themselves, then that is not somebody I would want to work with. I do believe there's some people who are beyond redemption. They're beyond rehabilitation and healing. And I do think those people need to be put away, if not castrated, if they're male people. I know that's a radical view, but I feel like anybody who uses their genitals as weapons should be disarmed. I feel pretty strongly about that. However, there are a lot of people who have either passed on in their attempt to try to understand what had happened to them. They end up perpetrating in order to either cause the pain that they have endured or try to alleviate or understand the pain that they've endured, or just have company and misery. I do think that's a human tendency as well. But many of those people feel a lot of remorse and they don't want to be that way. And I feel it's so important to help people understand that they also are part of a larger system and a larger society, not just a family system, but a whole culture that supports and perpetuates a lot of abusive behaviors. Obviously, just look at who just became Secretary of Defense, for Christ's sake. So I think it's a beautiful way to help people see what they've experienced and to alter their perspective and hopefully their behavior by affording them the same compassion as well as rigor in recognizing what they have done, the impact they have had, and to make amends in whatever way is appropriate, including jail time, if that's what has been decreed. And I don't know, I certainly have hurt people I never wanted to hurt. I think people who, again, sincerely want to heal have the right to do so. And because of my own history and experience and challenges to heal from my own sexual traumas, I want to do what I can to have fewer of them in the world, you know, fewer perpetrators and fewer victims. So I think it's really a beautiful opportunity. This work really lends itself to doing that work. And I hope to be able to do a documentary film actually about this, because I think the more we learn about what's behind perpetration for individuals and also get to see if there are patterns that are visual and palpable enough for us to understand so that we can change that as a society and support individuals to be otherwise.
Is there a particular case that comes to mind that maybe you could share, just a unique insight or anything that stuck with you?
Yeah, I talk about this in my classes too, in my foundations class, because it had such a massive impact on me. When people work with sexual issues as a facilitator, one of the things I talk about is the first thing I talk about, the importance of recognizing one's biases. Because I do think it's sacred responsibility to be as non-judgmental as possible about any sexual issue, with the exception of bestiality, for example. That's one of my main biases. I love animals too much to be able to tolerate that kind of behavior of perpetration on other species that have no way of defending themselves and aren't part of the whole human mishigas, you know. But another bias that I have, I don't know if it's a bias so much as a sensitivity I have, is with peeping Toms. Like, that is really difficult for me. And I ended up at the Center for Health and Sex with a client who came in who had been mandated by the court to be in rehabilitation for this behavior. And he was also quite an unattractive man, like ugly, which is fairly rare, actually. So that was one of the first things. You were asking about how I read bodies, when I'm looking at bodies, what I'm perceiving. So of course, I noted that as an individual, as a person, and had to experience a degree of repulsion when I saw this person. But then I got really curious, like, what would that be like to go through life looking the way he looked? Thus, what I was talking about before, our bodies form our lives and our lives form our bodies. How he looks to people form his life? So then it comes out that he has been peeping Tomming on people. And I had to stay as regulated as possible within myself, because I couldn't just say, no, I can't work with you. It was my job to work with him. And of course, I didn't want him to keep doing what he was doing. So when I asked him to place mats, he placed his mat right in front of the wall so no one could stand behind him. Nothing could be behind him but the wall. And behind us is, in the best sense, or in a perfect world, is where support happens, safety and support. People have our back. That's our classic phrase that we use in English. And there is something to somebody standing behind us and protecting our back. It's probably a universal phenomenon, unless you're somebody who's been attacked, molested, has untrustworthy parents or caretakers. So it really meant a lot when this guy put a wall behind him so that no one could ever stand behind him. Anyway, this whole session unfolded, and what he placed in his family system was so horrible. It was so uncomfortable and painful that what I realized ultimately, besides the fact I think he'd been abused in a variety of ways, actually there was something rather honorable about this person that I found so surprising, because I realized that a lesser, you could say, soul or a lesser person would have done far more than peeping. He would have been raping these women. The only reason why he wasn't was because of his restraint and also this deep imprint of needing to always keep a distance from other people. So we ended up working with how to begin to receive resourcing. Part of that was, can we move you away from the wall enough that someone or something, you name it, let's identify it, can you let this cohort that you've been in rehab with for over a week now, who you're starting to trust, can you let me stand behind there? No. Okay. What about if it's a man? What's that like? Can you take it in? Maybe only for 10 seconds, then you stand away. You can back up to the wall again. So it becomes a whole trauma process of titrating, pendulating, starting to reawaken or awaken perhaps for the first time his capacity as a body to start receiving some kind of safety and care. And of course, he ended up sobbing away, as we all did. But the point is that when we help people see the wholeness of what they've experienced and the pain and difficulty, the challenges of what they've experienced, we can start finding compassion and even beauty in people that I never would have expected to have found in this particular person, as just one example. And I suspect that's true of most people. If we were able to perceive people this way or were in sessions with people, we would discover all kinds of things that would surprise us about why people have done what they've done or believe what they believe, that is out of their struggle to survive and to belong and to feel that they're not just horrible people. Or I'll put it in a positive way, so that they're trying to feel lovable. You know, aren't we all? I am. I'm always struggling and trying to be more lovable as a human and as a being.
Does it just come down to that, do you think? Are we all on a molecular level just trying to belong? Because I've heard you say that several times now.
Well, that's one of the great cornerstone wisdoms of family constellation work. And not just that. I mean, anybody who studies wolves or sheep or all kinds of beings, fish and birds. Oh, God, it was so heartbreaking. A couple nights ago, the wild geese are migrating right now. And there's huge flocks of them just honking across the skies here. And two nights ago, before this huge storm, I saw this single goose just flying and wailing. Oh, just so heartbreaking, you know, just being lost out there in the skies. And it kept flying in all these different directions, you know, just trying to find its pack. I don't know what goose fleets are called, you know. And I thought, God, that's how a lot of us feel, you know, that first of all, unless you're a solitary species of one kind that does better by itself, you know, humans, we know, are social beings just by nature. And in order to thrive, we do need to have communities to which we belong. And of course, people do all kinds of crazy things and even immoral things in order to continue to belong. You know, Bert Hellinger, the founder of Constellation Work, called conscience actually a sensory organ. That conscience is actually our way of assessing what we need to do in order to continue to belong, who we need to be, what's acceptable to any given group, whether that be our family system or a church community or a political party or a nationality or a social group or a coupleship. God, yeah, I do. I think we're all longing to belong, and we want to ultimately not just belong in order to have a roof and food and clothes and a sense of place and be a part of an ecosystem, but we need to be loved, and we need to love.
I think the beautiful part of, at least in my experience with this work, is the opportunity to find perhaps even a different sense of belonging. Yes. Perhaps it's self-belonging. Perhaps it's building an emotional ecosystem for ourselves that maybe doesn't look like me going out and going to, you know, a Trump rally. Hate to bring it politically, but, you know, or it doesn't involve me hopping on the latest social media trend or, you know, fill in the blank there. But what is it that's going to give me the sense of belonging? That's going to make me feel like I have my place here in me, my body, who I am right now.
I love that, Lauren. Yeah, I think that there's belonging that comes from more superficial things about us, characteristics like, oh, I have white skin, you have white skin, we must belong with each other, as opposed to what does this deep inner being have in common with me? What are the values? hopefully that we have the capacity to love in common and to respect each other, at least, even if our external appearances look different. So I love that you're just talking about not just the belonging of self to self and hopefully self to others who might seem to be very different from us on the outside anyway. And then, of course, there's belonging to a sense of the world or of the universe or of God, which some of us have an easier time of than others. I'm still working on it at 63. Yeah, I have a sense of belonging in some ways. And I'd have to say, you know, I think that changes over time. We hopefully, at least some of us, I mean, I've always been quite nomadic and lived in many different places, and my sense of belonging will change in different communities, for example, or friendships will change over time. And I might belong with somebody or a lovership for a period of time, and then that changes and I may no longer belong. I mean, marriages are certainly like that, where people will belong with somebody or they feel they belong with them for 20, 30 years. And suddenly they, or not suddenly, they evolve into a sense of, I don't belong with this person anymore, you know, or chosen family. That's what that's all about, isn't it? So what I do know, Lauren, is I do feel like I belong with you. And I want to thank you for such a beautiful conversation that you and I get to have regularly. I am always enriched by the brilliance of your mind and body and being. And thank you so much for asking me those questions so that I get to share them with our listeners and share them more with myself, because you always ask me things that help me to think more clearly and excite me about what I'm doing. I love the work that I'm doing. And thank you for helping me remember even more of its facets.
Thank you for doing the work and for being resilient and excited and passionate. It's always wonderful to see the light in your face when you're excited about your point of view and sharing your take with the world. I think that this work is revolutionary. I'm excited to be a part of the conversation and to share it with you.
Love it. And Lauren, is there any way you want to let people know that you're this brilliant, creative being who's an amazing writer and speaker and clearly interviewer? Whoa, are you amazing to have a conversation with?
You can find me at Vikito Picasso on Instagram and also Genesis Productions, which is where I like to tell my stories, and hopefully launching my personal geometry practice very shortly.
Yes, indeed. This woman is a fantastic facilitator already, so I highly, highly recommend it. And I'm also starting a new cohort, which will be a 7-week class in foundations. And then from there, we'll go into all kinds of great teaching about how to work with sexuality and addiction. So we'd love to have you amongst us. And you can find that information also on my website, alimezey.com. Thank you so much for listening. It was wonderful to be able to share more about what we love and what we do and what our brilliant bodies know. And I hope this helped you to experience more of your brilliance. So until next time, take good care.
Thanks, Sally.
Bye. Bye, Lauren. Thanks again.
Bye.
Thanks so much for being with us. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. We'd be so grateful if you could share it with a friend, leave a review, and rate the podcast. This really does help us reach more people in our mission to expand the global understanding, experience, and celebration of body brilliance. And just so you know, our events and content remain free in our effort to expand the meaning of intelligence, but we do gratefully accept donations to help with our operating costs. So if you have a bit extra and feel so inspired, you can find the link to support us in the show notes. While you're there, check out all the resources we've included to help you dive deeper into today's topics. You can also visit www.thebrilliantbodypodcast.com for a complete list of episodes, body meditations, and many more brilliant things. And if you're curious to explore how I work with clients and students to reclaim body brilliance, visit my website at www.alimezey.com. And lastly, a huge hearty thank you to my co-producer and co-editor, the brilliant Florence Popoff, and to Blair, Mr. One Man Band Wilson, for our theme music. Until next time, stay curious, stay connected, stay loving, and reclaim your brilliant body.